Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. We're back with a new show next week, but today we're bringing you the perfect road trip playlist featuring some of our favorite past episodes. This week, stories about relationships challenged by illness, challenges that are sometimes physical, sometimes emotional. First, an essay by Robert Leleux about Alzheimer's and how for his family it was both a burden and a blessing. His piece is read by Oscar-nominated actor Michael Shannon. Michael's next film, due out in October, is called What They Had.
Your grandmother has Alzheimer's, right? The doctor asked me, scrawling notes into a floppy manila folder. I hadn't expected to discuss my grandmother's Alzheimer's with him. I was hoping to hear some explanation as to why, apart from her memory, my grandmother's overall health seemed so mysteriously improved. Her lupus, for instance, had all but disappeared from her blood work. Yes, but I begin. Well, there is a theory, he said, interrupting, that people with Alzheimer's heal themselves of their diseases because they forget they have them. I glanced across the room at my beautiful grandmother, smiling vaguely in her lipstick pink trench coat. But you don't really believe that, I said. The doctor shrugged with an implicit, who knows, which I found irritating because I hadn't flown all the way from Manhattan to Nashville to discuss fanciful theories. I wanted solid answers about Joanne's health, and he'd thrown me with his talk of miracle cures. But by that evening, after I had driven my grandparents home, I realized that the real reason this doctor had startled me was that for the first time I'd heard someone confirm my experience of my grandmother's disease. Alzheimer's has, in a sense, healed my grandmother and our family. 5 years ago, when Joanne's Alzheimer's was first diagnosed, I couldn't imagine anything less fair. At the time, I composed a mental list of all the people I knew who could lose their minds without anybody noticing. Scores of people whom I've never heard say one original thing. While my grandmother, on the other hand, was the genius of the cocktail party, a brunette version of our fellow Texan Ann Richards, who always seemed poised with a staggering stiletto quip. As a young artist in New York, I'd spent years trying to find my voice. When I did, it was my grandmother's. To this day, I've never liked anything I've created that didn't somehow remind me of her. So the fact that my clumsy development and slow self-discovery was occurring just as her decline began, felt like a tragic bargain. I was finding my voice just as she was losing hers. The only certainty about Alzheimer's is that it's characterized by uncertainty. There is no definitive test, no definitive diagnosis. So throughout that year, as my grandfather and I accompanied her to a legion of new doctors, each of whom mentioned the possibility of Alzheimer's, my grandmother grew ever more foggy, sometimes hilariously so. The wonderful thing about Alzheimer's, she would say, unfurling her arm like Betty Davis, is that you always live in the moment. Like many Southern women of her generation, my grandmother had been a stifled lady, prone to fits of drape-drawn depression, medicated with champagne and Streisand. Sad lives make funny people, she told me when I was 16. Humor was the way she had coped with every unpleasant thing in her life, from her long estrangement from my mother, her only child, to the onset of a crippling disease. But while my grandmother was able to laugh at her decline, her husband couldn't. He didn't find anything funny about watching her forget their life together. I think all my grandfather ever wanted was to be left alone with his wife, a goal he'd finally accomplished after more than 40 years of marriage when they retired from Houston to his family's Tennessee home. In this way, my grandparents reminded me of the Reagans, one of those couples who are so gaga for each other that there is no room for the kids. It's nobody's fault. It's just that perfect couples rarely have happy families. They have to have children because they love each other too much not to make something of it, but then the honeymoon never ends. And who brings their children on a honeymoon? It's like they always say, two's company, and three's an angry kid like Patty Davis, desperate for attention, with a complex about being shoved outside the magic circle. Except that in our case, Patty Davis was my mother, a Scarlett O'Hara for the Silicon Age, with a chest as big as her mouth and hair. Between these two genteel southern ladies, our family became an old west town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them. Which meant that my grandfather, Alfred, adoring Joanne as he did, not only stopped speaking to his daughter, he even stopped speaking about her, at least with me, until the day when we were finally forced to accept the fact of Joanne's Alzheimer's and its awful progression. The more Joanne forgot, the more often Alfred asked me to visit. And at the end of one of these Tennessee weekends, he suddenly blurted, "Sonny, I think it's time your mother came home for a visit." I was too surprised to say anything. Then he repeated, "I think it's time your mother came home." "I'll make it happen," I mumbled. "Good," he said, tapping the wheel. "It's time." Of course, I had no idea how I would make it happen. Fortunately, my mother, who for many years had been no stranger to a Bloody Mary, was newly sober, and I took advantage of that narrow window of Alcoholics Anonymous time before making amends becomes a crashing bore. All that summer, I begged her, long distance. I swore that if she would only visit her parents one more time, everything would be different. Finally, I played my ace. I asked her to visit them in Tennessee for my birthday in September. "Damn it," she screeched. "So now if I don't go, I'll be ruining your birthday." "Fine, I'll do it. But prepare yourself for disaster." "There won't be any disaster," I said. "Oh, really? Give me one good reason why things will be different this time." "Alzheimer's," I answered. For my grandfather and me, having to witness Joanne's Alzheimer's had been agonizing, like watching the miracle worker backward. Every day seemed accompanied by a new limitation. But for my grandmother, the disease seemed liberating. For the first time in all the years I'd known her, she'd seemed truly happy. Imagine, to be freed from your memory, to have every awful thing that ever happened to you wiped away, and not just your past, but your worries about the future, too. Because with no sense of time or memory, past and future ceased to exist, along with all sense of loss and regret. And that's the fantasy, isn't it? There had always been an element of existential fury to my grandmother's barbed wit concerning her lost time and missed chances. But as her Alzheimer's advanced, she forgot to be angry. And she seemed healthier, too. Her pace quickened, her complexion brightened, her hair thickened, and with my help and her husband's credit card, even her wardrobe improved. Her transformation was magical and unmistakable. It was certainly unmistakable to my mother on that bracing September day when my grandparents and I picked her up at the Nashville airport. "Look, Joanne," Alfred said, "it's Jessica." "Isn't that funny," said Joanne before embracing my mother. "That's my daughter's name, too." My mother forced a smile and shot me a wary look that abruptly softened once we got to the Buick and my grandmother reached for her hand. "Tell me all about yourself, darling," she said. "I want to know everything about you." All through my birthday dinner that evening, Joanne positively doted on her daughter, beaming sweetly and patting her hand. This behavior unsettled my mother, who afterward made a theatrical production of rooting through the closet in her bedroom. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Looking for space pods," she said. "Who are those people, Robert, and what have they done with my mother? I keep thinking I must be in a blackout, that I must be drunk in a ditch somewhere, and when I wake up I'll have the hangover of a lifetime, because believe me, if that nice old lady had been my mother, I'd never have left home." Now that my grandmother had, in a way, disappeared, she was fully present to my mother for perhaps the first time in their relationship. Now that she was all but unreachable, she was finally available. Each evening, as Joanne scooted close at dinner, my mother found the nearness less nerve-wracking. On the last day, as we were leaving for the airport, my grandfather kissed us goodbye. Suddenly, Joanne grabbed onto the lapels of my mother's jacket as if she were about to shake her. My mother looked rattled, but then Joanne said, "Thank you for coming, Jessica. I want you to know how much it means to me. I want you to know that I know we've never been close, and I know that's been mostly my fault. I'm not sure how much time I've got, but more than anything, I want to have a shot at spending it with you. It's so important. I mean, after all, Jessica, we're sisters." I groaned, then looked over to see my tough mother crying. "Close enough, Mama," she said.
Academy Award-nominated actor Michael Shannon reading Robert Lulu's essay, A Memory Magically Interrupted. Love is generosity. But just how much of yourself, your physical flesh and blood, would you give to the person you love? Here's comedian Sarah Silverman reading Angela Balsita's modern love essay, Beneath the Modest Alter Ego, I See My Superhero.
I was just 17, a typical college freshman concerned primarily with exploring my newfound freedom, my drinking skills, and the boys in the dorm next door, when one day I came home from sociology class with swollen ankles. "Oh my God," my roommate said, "you're pregnant." "That's not it," I assured her. When I called my mother, she scolded me. "It's because you're drinking too much." But when she told my father, who's a physician, about my condition, he grabbed the phone and said, "Come home." He took me to the hospital where specialists explained to me that I had a kidney disease called glomerulonephritis. I would have to start dialysis, a 3-hour, 3 days a week treatment to clean the waste out of my blood. Sitting up in my paper-thin hospital gown, I said, "You know, this really is not a good time." I tried to stick it out for the rest of the semester, dealing with dialysis while trying to maintain the life of an average Loyola college freshman. But the treatments exhausted me, and eventually I had to drop out. I moved back home to Pennsylvania, where I sat in my childhood bedroom for the rest of the school year, contemplating what the doctors said could be an alternative to dialysis, a kidney transplant. Luckily, I had an older brother who was sweet and selfless and, most important, healthy. "The surgery is usually harder on the donor," the surgeon told him. "I'm not worried," my brother said. It was not a surprise that his genes matched mine. But it was lucky that the surgery was easy, without complications. He recovered more quickly than expected, and the transplant appeared to be a success. Within months, I was back at school and on track to graduate on schedule. And it was during this time at a college lawn party that I met Christopher. Sitting in a t-shirt wearing a pair of gold Elvis sunglasses, he looked my direction and said, "Are you lonesome tonight, little lady?" As cheesy as his line was, I have to admit, I was hooked. One night as we sat in a crowded bar, I warned him about my kidney disease. I put every oddity and ailment of mine out there. "I have 3 kidneys," I said.
"So what? I have a Spock ear."
"I take like 9 medications every morning," I confessed.
"I get sunburned through skylights."
"I have a big nasty scar that goes from the side of my belly all the way down to below my bikini line."
"I have to see it," he said,
leaning across the table and then giving me a wink. My frank admissions didn't cause him to get up and leave, as often happened with other boys. He stayed and ordered another drink. And he continued to stay. Through years of medication changes, doctor appointments, and lab tests, he stayed as we sorted through all those life-changing decisions. Where are we going to move next? What will we do for work? And he stayed even when, years later, I began to reject my brother's kidney. Christopher watched as my young body quickly turned into that of an old woman. First with the reappearance of the swollen ankles, then with nausea and back pains, and finally with a limp in my step from the gout. I went back on dialysis, convinced that my luck had run out. I would need another new kidney, but from whom? Christopher committed to the transplant before we knew he was even a viable donor. He came into our kitchen and said, "I'll give you mine." The best part, I didn't even have to ask, but he had a few tough stipulations.
"You have to watch your diet."
I nodded enthusiastically.
"Whatever you say."
Under the table, my legs were shaking.
"No more drinking. I'm talking like a glass of wine at dinner, maybe. And no more smoking your occasional cigarettes."
"Okay," I said.
"If I give you my kidney, you've got to keep it. Be good to it."
I understood his concern. My record up to that point had not been the cleanest. When I went back to school after receiving my brother's kidney, I wanted to pick up right where I left off, trying to feel normal again among my peers. I partied to excess. I stayed out too late and exhausted myself on the weekends. I didn't think about what a life like that would eventually do to my already compromised state of health. "I promise," I said, but at that point I would have agreed to anything. We shook on our deal before he dipped me, a stare style, and planted his warm lips on mine. For weeks, the transplant team poked and prodded Christopher with blood tests, x-rays, and MRIs, assessing his viability. But I knew he'd be a match. I knew it from the way we finished each other's sentences and said the punchlines to each other's jokes. I knew it from the way he steadied me on hikes as I wobbled awkwardly on precarious boulders. And I was right. "Well, he's good enough," said the nurse when we met to hear the result. I watched her lips move as she gave us the details of the operation, but all I could think about was how love had saved me. When the transplant was over, my kidney function was restored, and I felt healthier than I had in a long time. But Christopher did not escape as cleanly. A few days after, his incision became infected. He began to feel weak. He lost his appetite. The doctors put him on bed rest for 6 weeks to allow the wound to heal. Though I finally felt better again, it was painful to watch this normally active guy stuck in a bed, staring at the wall day after day, and to know that he was there because of me. When my mother tells people at supermarkets about Christopher and me, they begin to cry. When he and I go out to dinner with other couples, I make them swoon with our love story. He saved my life, I tell them.
No, I didn't, Christopher says, smirking with annoyance.
But it was true despite his modesty. Then one weekend in November, just 3 months after the transplant, I woke up with a blinding headache that would not go away. Later, it spread into severe back pain and an astronomical fever. This is not happening, I thought, as they wheeled me from the emergency room to the ward. I would end up staying for 3 weeks as doctors examined my condition and watched my kidney function fluctuate. Every night as I prayed in my hospital bed that I would not lose this kidney, Christopher sat nearby reading a book or looking out for soccer scores on the wall-mounted TV. What would it mean if I were to reject his kidney, I wondered. What if he can't rescue me after all? In the end, my symptoms turned out to be a result of an infection, not of outright rejection. And while there was no major damage to the kidney, the illness did serious damage to the one thing that up until then I had been sure of, that love would save me. As someone who's been sick for the last 15 years, I'm always looking for the cure. I wait for the hero to swoop in and save the girl. The more romantic in my mind, the better. Christopher's version of our fairy tale has always been a bit different from mine, a little more pragmatic. When I say, marriage, what do we need marriage for? The fact that you gave me your kidney should show the world that we're destined to be together. And he says,
well, maybe we should get married so my health benefits can pay for your lab tests and maintenance drugs.
When I would say, what if I lose this kidney? He says, his voice calm and cool,
then I'll drive you to dialysis until you get a new one.
Chances are that is the position we will find ourselves in one day, and he seems to know it. He knows that even if I watch my salt, am tender with his kidney, and try in earnest to keep it with me, someday my body will discover that his kidney is foreign and strange and will try to get rid of it. Christopher is my match in terms of blood and tissue, along with being my match in almost every other conceivable way. And yet, in the end, even this may not be enough to deliver me from the pain and effects of my affliction. He may not be able to save my life, but in so many ways, he already has.
Sarah Silverman, reading Angela Balsita's essay, Beneath the Modest Alter Ego, I See My Superhero. Here's Angela Balsita.
So after the piece, Chris and I got married. And shortly after it was published, we had our daughter, Nico. And it was kind of a risk when we had her, because we knew that Chris's kidney was functioning quite well, and we were on this nice, healthy road. So we got pregnant, and she was born early, but she was healthy. The pregnancy was a lot on the kidney, and the kidney wasn't able to recover. So shortly after she was born, I lost Chris's kidney. So the piece is interesting to me because it was very much about me being very hopeful that this kidney was going to last us forever and our love was going to pull us through.
My name is Christopher Doyle, and I'm Angela's husband. When Angela's kidney, the one I donated, gave out, I was really disappointed in my kidney. I thought it could have been much hardier. Obviously, it did bring our daughter into the world, so I guess it kind of has a saving grace, and if it had to go out, it went out with a bang.
They had a beautiful baby girl, But losing Chris's kidney meant that Angela had to spend the first year of her daughter's life on dialysis.
It was not what I expected motherhood to be like at all. Being sick while she was getting stronger and stronger every day. But since then, Nico, our daughter, she's almost 8. She's healthy. And after my third transplant, I am also healthy and strong. A friend decided to donate her kidney to me. She had been with us through this whole time and knew that I was in trouble and needed help. And the rest is smooth sailing in history, hopefully.
Angela and Chris will celebrate their 10th anniversary later this year. They live in Baltimore, where Angela's a high school English teacher.
My life today is so normal and so boring, and I love it. I love how boring it is. I love that I don't have to worry about the next event that's going to happen to my body, right? Or worry about the next trauma that we have to deal with. I love that I can teach writing and talk about writing all day, that I get to take care of my kid. That's, I think, something some of us might take for granted. But I get to take care of her, right, instead of other people taking care of me. I have 5 kidneys in my body. They don't take them out. They just keep them in there. I don't know. I kind of like the idea of having them all in there. I have my brother, my husband, and my dear friend all in my body, like quite literally, right? And that's pretty beautiful.
Angela Balsita. We also heard from her husband, Christopher Doyle. Angela shares more of their story in her 2011 memoir, Moonface. And now, Modern Love editor Daniel Jones shares what he took away from Angela's story.
I like what she says in this essay about how she kept trying to read a greater meaning or sense of fate into this decision by her boyfriend to give her a kidney. And I like how she gets beyond that and thinks, okay, well, love isn't the thing that's saving me. A healthy kidney is saving me. And it was a loving act that brought that kidney to me and let me have it. But if the kidney fails, then it's the kidney that's letting me down, not the person, not love itself. When it gets right down to it, it's about real things and real people and failing organs. And I think we're better off if we stop thinking it was either meant to be this way or it was not meant to be this way.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. And I really agree with Dan, because that seems to be the lightning bolt in so many of our modern love stories, that in life and in love, we are so fortunate simply to be. Special thanks to Sarah Silverman for reading Angela's essay. Her Hulu show, I Love You, America, was just nominated for an Emmy Award for Best Variety Sketch Series. We've got more after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
In sickness and in health, perhaps you're one of the many who has vowed to stand by your partner on both sides of this promise. But like so many things in marriage, it's easier said than done. Eric Gumney and his wife Monica know this all too well. Chris Messina stars in Sharp Objects on HBO. He reads Eric's essay, When Love Isn't As Simple as Standing by Your Man.
My wife and I used to joke about how much better we were than other couples. How we'd never had the petty fights and misunderstandings that everyone else seemed to be having. Together, we had weathered layoffs, a cross-country move, multiple hospitalizations for my cystic fibrosis, and the housebreaking of two terrier puppies. Yet somehow we always managed to come out stronger than before. Our love was indestructible. Then she threatened to leave me 6 weeks after I had a double lung transplant. When you're being evaluated for a transplant, there are a lot of things the nurses and medical professionals tell you over and over again to drive home the significance, to make sure you're truly prepared, and probably to keep you from suing them later. There's a good chance you may die, they tell you, either during the surgery or while waiting for it. They show you pictures of how physically racked your body's going to be in the days after the procedure. They give you documents explaining that you may die, what the cost of prescriptions will be, and how high the risk of death is. They explain that you're going to be allergic to grapefruit and turtles afterward. For a while, you won't be able to lift anything heavier than a gallon of milk. And, oh yeah, death is a distinct possibility. There are also a lot of things the medical professionals don't mention. The stench of stale milk emanating from the nutritional supplements stacked in a corner of your rented bedroom. The wild mood swings, the muscle spasms. The sound an oxygen tank makes when a valve breaks at 2 a.m. Like the inside of a tornado. And what it feels like when antibiotics turn your colon into a water slide. None of the pamphlets mention the psychological toll of waiting to die or of waiting for, even grimly rooting for, someone else to die so that you can get that person's lungs. They don't explain how not to feel like a monster about that. No one tells you that the physical scars are the easy ones. My wife, Monica, knows this all intimately now, better even than I do. While I was high on anti-anxiety medications and cannabis-based appetite stimulants, she was the one who had to remain clear-headed enough to clean up after me and keep us rolling in buckets of expensive prescriptions. She didn't have the luxury of mentally checking out the way I did. She would spend her mornings dealing with the gruesome symptoms of my death spiral, and then spend the afternoons trying to do her day job from my hospital room. Monica and I bought a home in Albuquerque about 6 months before my lungs decided they no longer wanted to be lungs. There is nowhere in New Mexico where you can get a lung transplant, legally or otherwise. The local cystic fibrosis clinic worked in tandem with the transplant team at Stanford Hospital in California, summoning information and x-rays, and then, when things really went off the rails, moving me via emergency airlift. Monica spent the first 2 weeks sleeping on a cot in my tiny hospital room, both because I was a disaster and because she didn't have anywhere else to go. In between consoling me and checking in with the doctors and corralling the parents and coordinating with our friends to drive our car and all our stuff out west, Monica also had to find us a cheap apartment in one of the most expensive markets in the world before I could be even tenuously released from the hospital. We had to stay within an hour of Stanford Hospital. I wasn't going to be allowed to go back to Albuquerque unless I became significantly less almost dead. Bills began piling higher on our makeshift dining room table, a rickety card table from IKEA. Monica kept working, fundraising, and taking care of me. 2 months later, I was on 6 liters of oxygen while sitting still. I could barely eat. 3 months after that, My wife was bathing me like a child as I shivered and huddled in the tub, trying not to have a panic attack. Monica had known about the cystic fibrosis since our third date, about the possibility of a transplant since shortly after. We had made it through some rough exacerbations and pneumonias before, argued with insurance companies and hospitals. We thought we could handle anything that the transplant could throw at us. All the papers and preparation in the world, though, can't get you ready for how radically life-altering the transplant process is. How fundamentally less than human you become while waiting and wasting away. No brochure explains what that does to those watching you. 7 months after arriving in Palo Alto, we finally received the call. An organ donor of the correct size and blood type, within an acceptable distance for rapid transport, had died. And I received my double lung transplant. A 9-hour procedure that went well. Within a week of surgery, I was out of the hospital and back in our apartment with only Tylenol for the pain. We had the respiratory therapy company collect the oxygen tanks and tubes. We tossed all the nutritional supplements. Things were finally getting back to normal. Except we still couldn't go home. We needed to stay near Stanford Hospital for at least 3 more months. I still couldn't walk. My leg muscles had atrophied from the months of failing lung capacity and bed rest. And my new lungs still needed to be broken in. I needed physical therapy to learn to breathe again, to function as a human being. I was still only half a person. I don't think I could do this anymore, Monica said. Monica was a teary, snotty mess the night she blindsided me with the news that she may have to leave me if I didn't get healthier, faster. It was mid-October, less than 2 months after the transplant. I was more terrified in that moment than I had been at any time during my hospitalizations or at any time they had to cut me open. The world itself seemed to stop. Despite the 20 pounds I had gained, the 6'2" frame I had finally filled, I felt small and helpless. She was towering over me, crying, sniffling, trying to explain. She had already bought a plane ticket home. I was wearing new pajamas. I had a pile of pills on the table. A window opened to the street at my back. I could hear the cars at the light braking, stopping, going. After my mother flew in to relieve her, Monica left for New Mexico. I spent those next days and weeks feeling wounded, incensed. I tried to distract myself by building a haunted gingerbread house for Halloween, but couldn't help dwelling on Monica's betrayal. How could she? I ranted to myself, smoldering. Who does something like that? I fumed as I applied icing to the roof. Do I have to wait until Halloween to eat this? I was still on a lot of drugs at that point, and it was hard to stay focused. Monica and I didn't talk much while she was gone. Once I knew she was coming back, though, I began deciding what I was going to say to her, how I was going to explain how hurt and upset I was that she would simply abandon me after everything I had gone through. And there it was. I hadn't gone through anything. We had. Together. Every problem my waning health presented, Monica had to handle twice over, worrying about me and worrying about her life after me if it all went sideways. Every time someone told me I was going to die, she had to sit there silently, taking it in. I could shrug off all the dire news and flip to the Cartoon Network, but she didn't have that option. She had to deal with the information, the issues, and the repercussions. Acting as a nursemaid, housekeeper, chauffeur, and lawyer for me, the man who was supposed to share her life, not consume it. I don't think I can do this anymore. Her words haunted me for weeks. But I was wrong about them. They weren't an ultimatum. They were a proclamation of defeat. Monica needed a break from doing the impossible. Her hasty retreat didn't mean she was done with me. It meant she was as broken as I was. My wife and I don't joke about how great we are anymore. We realize now how precarious, how fragile a claim like that really is. Our love may be indestructible, but we sure as hell aren't.
Chris Messina, reading Eric Gumney's essay, When Love Isn't As Simple as Standing By Your Man. Eric is in good health now, but he told us that the physical scars continue to be the easier ones to heal.
Somebody did have to die for me to be alive, and that is a really heavy burden and a responsibility. And if you think about that, it's kind of hard to just take in your day-to-day life where you're making money and paying your mortgage and just living your life. I get kind of like a heavier feeling, almost a little bit of depression just thinking about it. So it is just kind of a way to keep moving forward. I kind of don't think about it as often as maybe I used to.
Eric and Monica are still married, and they went to the studio together for this conversation. Monica told us about the beginning of their relationship before she had any idea what she was getting into.
So when I first met him, I just thought he had maybe a little bit of a cold, maybe some allergies. He would cough sometimes. He did tell me, I think third date, and it was pretty shocking. But I basically kept waiting for him to screw up for other reasons so I wouldn't have to deal with it. I was like, he'll be a terrible guy at some point, and it'll be way better than being like a jerk who breaks up with some guy. So that was my plan, and then he kept being awesome, so it didn't work.
But of course, Monica did leave at one point, but just for 2 weeks.
I know I needed a break. I knew that I was frustrated and feeling a bit abandoned myself. He hadn't been himself in so long, and I was out of whatever reserves I had left, and he was well enough that I felt okay to leave.
Monica had no idea that Eric thought she was leaving for good.
You know, when she was reading one of the drafts, she was like, what are you talking about? That's not how I saw that at all. That's not what happened. And then so we finally just kind of sat down, like, wait, what did you think was happening? And so she explained it. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. And it's not nearly as terrible as what I thought it was. But it just wasn't a conversation we had until, you know, a year and a half later or something like that.
The more I kind of reflect on it, I realize that while I was in New Mexico, I had an inkling that this mattered a whole heck of a lot more to him, that I was away and having fun and he wasn't. I'm not talking, ooh, I was partying. I'm talking, I went to the park with my dog and it was the best day. Like, and the simple, simple stuff. So I didn't know he felt that way. And if I did on any level, honestly, I couldn't take on any more of his pain. I needed to go away and like recharge and not be worried about him. Because I've been worried continuously for most of a year.
Monica isn't alone. After Eric's essay was published, he heard from many people who had been in Monica's situation. They understood her need for a break. Eric also heard from a hospital that wanted to start a caregiver support group in response to his essay.
A few social workers reached out, like, thank you for bringing that up. We really need to be better about making sure caregivers are taken care of, making sure they're not overworked and, you know, overtaxed like that. So I think that was a really good benefit of the essay coming out that we weren't really anticipating in any fashion at all.
Eric is currently working on a novel about his transplant. He and Monica still live in Albuquerque, and with Eric's illness at bay, they're able to focus on some of their other goals.
I mean, it's back to little things, like we want to get a new washer and dryer. Like, you know, like that's our big goal, to save up some money to maybe redo the kitchen. It's nothing major. We're just kind of enjoying it because it's nice to not have to worry about, oh, we need 60 grand for a transplant, or like we need to make sure we have 10 grand in reserve in case we have to fly out to Stanford on like a medevac. It's really just nice to have little, smaller, reasonable goals, and we're just kind of enjoying that.
I'm going to get him on a horse. That's another goal. He's never done that.
Eric Gumney and his wife, Monica Rodriguez. Thanks to Chris Messina, who read this week's story. He told us about his own connection to Eric's experience.
Well, unfortunately, I had a friend that I went to college with that had lung complications and died. And so when I read this story, I thought of my time with him, and I thought of all his struggles that he told me about. So the story spoke to me.
Chris Messina. You can see him now alongside Amy Adams on HBO's Sharp Objects. Here's Daniel Jones.
I think when we're looking forward to marriage and we're thinking about it in these idealistic ways, it's really helpful to read stories like this and understand that you don't always have to be at your best. You can be weak at times. In fact, at my own wedding, my wife and I had several poems read, and one was about, described marriage as one person holding up the ceiling for a while and then being able to put his hands down and have the other person hold up the ceiling for a while. And it was sort of a simplistic but true way of capturing what marriage is like. You can't expect one person to be strong the whole time to take care of someone who happens to be going through a long, weak stretch. It's just too much to ask.
Don't be an open book on a first date. The general theory is you shouldn't scare people away by unloading all of your secrets at the same time. But when you're suffering from a mental illness, telling the truth at any point in the relationship could be a deal breaker. Or at least that's what Terry Cheney thought. Rebecca Hall reads Terry's essay, and she takes us deep into the inner life and inner workings of Terry's mind. Here is Take Me As I Am, Whoever I Am.
As a bipolar woman, I have lived much of my life in a constant state of becoming someone else. The precise term for my disorder is ultra-radian rapid cycler, which means that without medication, I am at the mercy of my own spectacular mood swings, up for days, charming, talkative, effusive, funny, and productive, but never sleeping and ultimately hard to be around. Then down, and essentially immobile, for weeks at a time. This darkness started for me in high school, when I simply couldn't get out of bed one morning. No problem, except I stayed there for 21 days. As this pattern continued, my parents, friends, and teachers grew concerned. But they just thought that I was eccentric. After all, I remained a stellar student, never misbehaved, and graduated as class valedictorian. Vassar was the same, where I thrived academically despite my mental illness. I then sailed through law school and quickly found career success as an entertainment lawyer in Los Angeles, where I represented celebrities and major motion picture studios. All the while I searched for help through an endless parade of doctors, therapists, drugs, and harrowing treatments like electroshock, to no avail. Other than doctors, nobody knew. At work, where my skills and productivity were all that mattered, I could hide my secret with relative ease. I kept friends and family unaware with elaborate excuses, only showing up when I was sure to impress. But my personal life was another story. In love, there's no hiding. You have to let someone know who you are. But I didn't have a clue who I was from one moment to the next. When dating me, you might go to bed with Madame Bovary and wake up with Hester Prynne. Worst of all, my manic, charming self was constantly putting me into situations that my down self couldn't handle. For example, one morning I met a man in the supermarket produce aisle. I hadn't slept for 3 days, but you wouldn't have known it to look at me. My eyes glowed green, my strawberry blonde hair put the strawberries to shame, and I literally sparkled. I'd worn a gold sequined shirt to the supermarket. Manic taste is always bad. I was hungry, but not for produce. I was hungry for him, in his well-worn jeans, Yankees cap slightly askew. I pulled my cart alongside his and started lasciviously squeezing a peach. I like them nice and firm. Don't you? He nodded. And no bruises. That's all I needed. An opening and I was off. I told him my name, asked him his likes and dislikes in fruit, sports, presidential candidates, and women. I talked so quickly I barely had time to hear his answers. I didn't buy any peaches, but I left with a dinner date on Saturday, 2 nights away, leaving plenty of time to rest, shave my legs, and pick out the perfect outfit. But by the time I got home, the darkness had already descended. I didn't feel like ploughing through my closet or unpacking the groceries. I just left them on the counter to rot or not rot. What did it matter? I didn't even change my sequined shirt. I tumbled into bed as I was and stayed there. My body felt as if I'd been dipped in slow-drying concrete. It was all I could do to draw a breath in and push it back out, over and over. I would have cried from the sheer monotony of it, but tears were too much effort. On Saturday afternoon, the phone rang. I was still in bed and had to force myself to roll over, pick it up and mutter, "Hello?" "It's Jeff, from the Peaches. Just calling to confirm your address." "Jeff? Peaches?" I vaguely remember talking to someone who fit that description, but it seemed a lifetime ago. And that wasn't me doing the talking then, or at least not this me. I'd never wear sequins in the morning. But my conscience knew better. "Get up, get dressed," it hissed in my ear. "It doesn't matter if she made the date. You've got to see it through." When Jeff showed up at 7, I was dressed and ready, but more for a funeral than a date. I was swathed in black and hadn't put on any makeup, so my naturally fair skin looked ghostly and wan. But I opened the door and even held up my cheek to be kissed. I took no pleasure in the feel of his lips on my skin. Pleasure was for the living. I had nothing to say, not then or at dinner. So Jeff talked, a lot at first, then less and less, until finally, during dessert, he asked, "You don't by any chance have a twin, do you?" And yet I was crushed when he didn't call. A couple of weeks later, I awoke to a world gone Disney. Daffodil sunshine, robin's egg sky. Birds were trilling outside my window, a song no doubt created especially for me. I couldn't stand it a minute longer. I flung back the covers and danced in my nightie. My grey flannel prison issue nightie. I caught one glimpse of it in the mirror, shuddered and flung it off too. I rifled through my closet for something decent to wear. But everything I put my hands on was wrong, wrong, wrong. For starters, it was all black. I hated black. Even more than I hated grey. Redheads should be true to their colours, whatever the cost. I dug deeper, and there, shoved way in the back, was a pair of skin-tight jeans and something silky and sparkly and just what I needed. An exquisite gold sequined shirt. Damn, I looked good. Then I tugged on the jeans. I'd gained a few pounds during the last couple of weeks of sloth-like existence, but once I yanked really hard, they zipped up fine. Although something was sticking out of the pocket. A business card with a few words scribbled across the back. "Call me Jeff." Jeff. Jeff! I kicked the nightie out of my way and grabbed the bedside phone. Was 6:30 a.m. too early to call? No, not for good old Jeff. It rang. And rang. I was about to give up when a thick, sleepy voice said, "Hello?" "It's me! Why haven't you called?" It took a while to establish who me was, but eventually he remembered. "You sound different," he said. "Or no, maybe you sound more like yourself. I'm not sure, it's so early." Soon I had him laughing so hard he got the hiccups and had to get off the phone. But before he did, he asked me out for Friday, 3 nights away. "No," I insisted, "it had to be tonight. Or even this afternoon." I didn't want to lose another chance to get to know him. I knew that Cinderella had only so much time left at the ball. We compromised on dinner that evening at 8. I spent the afternoon ridding my house of all evidence of depression. I soaped and scoured and dusted and vacuumed, using every attachment, even the ones that frightened me. Then I ran out and bought a dozen Casablanca lilies to hide the smell of ammonia and bleach. When the house looked perfect, I turned on myself with the same fury. I buffed and polished and creamed and plucked and did everything in my power to recreate Rita Hayworth's smoky allure in Gilda. As I was shadowing my eyes, I remembered her poignant line about the movie. "Every man I've known has fallen in love with Gilda and wakened with me." It gnawed at me, to the point that my hand started trembling and I couldn't finish applying my mascara. Suddenly I didn't look radiant. There were lines around my mouth and a hollowness to my eyes that aged me 10 years. My skin, despite the carefully applied foundation and blush, was so deathly pale I recoiled from my reflection. I sat on the toilet and started to cry. I had met the enemy enough times to know it by sight. "Not now," I prayed. "Please, not now." Globs of mascara ran down my cheeks, and I wiped them away, heedless of the streaks they left. It was 7:57. I had 3 minutes to wrestle my brain chemistry into submission. Oh, sure. I knew there was another option. I could tell Jeff what was going on. But this was a man who didn't even like his peaches bruised. What would he think of a damaged psyche? Maybe he would understand. Maybe I would find the courage. Maybe they would invent a cure. Maybe, but not tonight. As the doorbell rang and rang, I huddled in the bathroom, shivering. I was terrified. Not just of Jeff finding me there, but of me never once finding love. When it was finally quiet, I rinsed off the rest of my mascara and tossed my cocktail dress into the hamper. Then I buttoned up my grey flannel nightie and settled in for the long night to come. I never heard from Jeff again. That was 5 years ago. 5 long years of ups and downs, of searching for just the right doctor and just the right dose. I've finally accepted that there is no cure for the chemical imbalance in my brain, any more than there is a cure for love. But there's a little yellow pill I'm very fond of, and a pale blue one, and some pretty pink capsules, and a handful of other colours that have turned my life around. Under their influence, I'm a different person yet again. Neither Madame Bovary nor Hester Prynne, but someone in between. I have moods, but they don't send me spinning into an alternate persona. Stability, ironically, is so exciting, I have decided to venture into dating again. I have succumbed to pressure from friends and signed up for 3 months of a computer dating service. Who are you? The questionnaire asks at the start. I want to be honest, but I don't know how to answer. Who am I now, or who was I then? Life seems so much tamer these days, deceptively quiet, like a tiger with velveted paws. Every so often the sun shines too bright, and I think, for a moment, that I own the sky. I think how wonderful it was to be Gilda, if only in my own mind. But then I remember the price of the sky. So I take off my makeup, rumple my hair, and go to the supermarket in sweats. The gold sequined shirt languishes in my closet. I'm thinking of giving it away. Not just yet.
Rebecca Hall, reading Terry Chaney's essay, Take Me As I Am, Whoever I Am. When Terry's piece was published, she unexpectedly became a poster girl for bipolar disorder.
I was inundated by emails, I'd say maybe thousands of them, telling me their stories with bipolar disorder and thanking me for telling mine. And while there were many sad stories, there was also a lot of courage and resilience and just empathy for the condition.
When her book Manic, a Memoir, was published 2 weeks later, it shot to the top of the bestseller lists. Then requests for speaking engagements came pouring in from across the globe. All welcome, of course, but Terry's struggle with bipolar disorder made it more difficult to take full advantage of these new opportunities.
Well, it's a day-by-day situation. Actually, for the past several years, I've been pretty stable on medications. Thank God we have the right cocktail at the moment, because I've seen what I'm like without it, and it isn't pretty. But there are definitely times when I just wish I could be highly manic again and have that exhilaration. But I know the consequences by now, and it just isn't worth it.
So what was it like to reveal this very personal story in such a public way?
Before Manic came out, I didn't disclose to anyone about my illness, not my lovers, my friends, my coworkers, nobody except my doctors. And then after Manic was published, I suddenly got all these emails from ex-lovers, ex-boyfriends saying, I always knew there was something wrong with you. I just couldn't put my finger on it. Now it completely makes sense. So I was able to repair a lot of those broken relationships, which was certainly a benefit I didn't expect from disclosure. I was so terrified to tell anyone.
And did she ever hear from the guy, Jeff?
I never heard from Jeff again. It was funny. I expected to when the essay came out because I heard from, it seemed, every other person in my past crawled out of the woodwork, but I did not hear from him.
Terry is in a great relationship now. Her partner has taken the time to understand what it means to be bipolar and what it means to date someone with bipolar disorder. He's so familiar with Terry's ups and downs that he can even see when trouble might be coming.
The Santa Ana winds were predicted to blow in Southern California, and he warned me ahead of time that, okay, you're going to get manic, because I always get manic during Santa Ana's. And he told me to, you know, batten down the hatches, call my therapist, take my medication. I mean, he knew before I did what was going to happen.
Terry will be bipolar for the rest of her life. But does she ever wish it all away?
My answer to that is no. I get so many strange benefits from it, my creativity being probably the most salient, but also just a sense of being empathetic and more attuned to the world, I think, than many other people.
Terry Chaney is author of Take Me As I Am, Whoever I Am. She lives in Los Angeles and continues to write full time. The emotional terrain modern love covers is intense and complex. From open adoption to suicide, war, death, disease. So why do so many people share their deepest secrets through this column? Well, we asked Dan Jones.
I don't know why modern love has become, in a way, such a platform for people to admit to and describe in detail really sensitive, vulnerable things about themselves that then can be read about by hundreds of thousands of people or more. There's a little bit of an important sort of self-delusion that comes with personal essay writing, where when you're in the process of doing it, you aren't really imagining an audience, or at least a lot of people who submit to Modern Love aren't, because the odds of getting published are really slim. And there's something that is very both sort of cathartic, liberating, intense, and brave in a personal way about doing that. You know, they can control the message. It's in their words. And once they have that control and feel like they have that control, they can really just sort of open the floodgates and say, okay, this is who I am.
More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Nicole Carr seems like any other young mom, balancing career and family, rushing from activity to activity, and working to keep her marriage strong. But Nicole has another challenge. She's slowly going blind. Here's her modern love piece, Together Always, in Darkness and in Light, read by Tony Award-winning actress Patina Miller.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind. I chose the best of lousy options. I broke the news after sex, and I packaged it right. At 22, David was a novelist just starting his career, and I knew if I framed my plight as poetic, he'd find it irresistible, at least on a narrative level. So lying next to him in the dark, I told the story like a gothic novel. I started with how 3 years earlier at 19, I realized I couldn't see the stars at night. This seemed like an innocent enough detail until it turned out to be the first symptom of an incurable degenerative retinal disease. The doctor told me I would slowly lose my eyesight over the next 10 to 15 years. First my nighttime and peripheral vision, and later my central vision too. I ended on a high note. Losing my vision, I explained, was teaching me to really see. I would go blind with a bang, not a whimper, by seeing and doing more in the next decade than most people did in a lifetime. All true, but only part of the story. The pretty part. Our romance was still new, and I was nervous about how he would react to my disclosure. His response, though, was as grand and poetic as the story itself. The next time we met, he wore my name on his arm. 6 lowercase letters stained the skin indelibly. As I admired the tattoo, he told me I had lit his darkness and he would light mine. No matter what came, he said, we would face it together. He was all in. I met David at our last semester in college, where we were both English and theater majors. I liked that he was smart, but not pretentious, funny, but never mean. I liked his disarming sincerity, so different from my own reliance on charm and subterfuge. There was a solidity to him, and it made me feel safe for the first time since my diagnosis. Where David was heavy, I was light. Where he was restrained, I was freewheeling. I made him laugh and got him to do things that scared him, like moving to Los Angeles. He was a small-town Southern boy who had always dreamed of living in California but was never ready to take the plunge until I took it with him. In Los Angeles, David helped me with my acting auditions and I edited his manuscripts. On weekends, we lowered the top on his beat-up convertible and drove up the Pacific Coast Highway, our music loud. The Golden Hills looked like the backs of sleeping lions, we agreed. David drove for hours, one-handed, because the other hand was melded to mine. Our life together was a grand romance, and my encroaching blindness was more blessing than curse because it galvanized us to live with urgency. The blindness was poetic because it hadn't happened yet. In the abstract, blindness is epic, noble, simple. In reality, it's a different story altogether. In reality, it's tedious, draining, messy. It changes you in surprising ways, some positive and some not. It's a lot like the reality of being married. Ten years in, on my 33rd birthday, I found myself sobbing, alone, on a stoop in Brooklyn. I had quit acting because I could no longer navigate the dark stages and sets. We had moved back to Brooklyn, my hometown, because my driving had become untenable. We had gotten married and had a son, a long, lithe baby with bee-stung eyes. I was elated I could discern these details, and just as overjoyed to see the round cheeks and bold lips of my newborn daughter 2 years later. I watched the color of their eyes deepen into blue, and seeing these changes suffused me with gratitude. But I was suffused, too, with fear. The year of our daughter's birth marked the 10-year anniversary of my diagnosis, and by then, I had lost enough sight to be deemed legally blind. My eyesight had closed in like the aperture on a camera, leaving me with extreme tunnel vision. I constantly collided into people and things. Monkey bars, fire hydrants, cabinet doors left ajar. I developed cataracts that made it difficult for me to fill out forms at the pediatrician's office or, really, read anything at all. I had been so busy making the most of my vision that I hadn't prepared myself for losing it. I never spoke of my disease, not even to the few people who knew about it. Concealing my vision loss was isolating and frightening. I was scared I would walk the stroller into a manhole or lose my children at the playground, scared of a future in which I could no longer see their faces. My confidence had taken a hit, too. I gave up wearing heels because I fell in them, gave up eyeliner because I couldn't put it on straight, gave up reading because I couldn't make out print, I felt like I wasn't just losing my sight, but essential parts of what made me me. Because I had no other resources in my place for support. The onus fell to David, who became my surreptitious seeing eye guy. All of that, in addition to the typical strains of raising two young children, was taxing on a marriage. On my 33rd birthday, David and I splurged on a sitter and planned a dinner out with friends. I spent an hour applying makeup in a magnifying mirror, only to have David observe it was a little, uneven. On the walk to the restaurant, we reopened the debate about whether or not to have a third child. I wanted to, but was terrified I wouldn't be able to take care of the baby with my failing vision. David told me he would follow my lead, but he didn't see how we would possibly make it work. Our resources, money, time, and yes, vision, were already so limited. Halfway to the restaurant, our discussion developed into an argument, which ended with David storming off and telling me to go to the party without him. I stopped in my tracks, crumpled onto the nearest stoop, and I sobbed. I wasn't helpless. I could find my way home. But I couldn't go to the party without him. I couldn't see well enough to find my friends or read the menu. I needed David, and he resented it, and I resented his resentment. I remembered how I had told him I would go blind with a bang and not a whimper, and how he had promised we would always be together in darkness and in light. Seemed like we'd both been wrong. Some minutes later, David's big brown boots, the ones I always tripped over when he left them by the door, stepped into frame. "You can't just leave me," I said. "I need you." "I know," he said. "I hate it." "So do I." Then he took my hand and said we'd figure it out. We're still figuring it out. The thing about slowly losing something that feels indispensable is you're constantly adjusting to the loss. As soon as you find a comfortable balance, something shifts and you have to recalibrate. Not long after my birthday, I called the New York State Commission for the Blind, which taught me how to use a mobility cane and adaptive technology. I got a magnifier, so I didn't need David to measure the children's Tylenol or adjust the thermostat. I reclaimed my abilities I had lost and started to make peace with what I had to let go. A year later, David took me to dinner and said he had something to tell me. His face was hazy in the candlelight, but I could see his mouth breaking into a smile. "I think we should have another baby," he said. I blinked. "But what about..." David took my hand and cut me off. "We'll figure it out." He spoke with the same certainty that made him tattoo my name on his arm so long ago. His faith bred faith in me. We would have another child, and it would be hard and spectacular, and we would be in it together. Together in moments glorious and tedious, whatever else it was, poetic, prosaic, and everything in between, our story would be ours to share.
Tina Miller, reading Nicole Carr's modern love piece, Together Always, in Darkness and in Light. We're back next week with a new episode with Ethan Hawke.
I came home from work on a rainy November afternoon, more than a decade ago, to find a 20-foot U-Haul truck in my driveway, and behind it, a police car. My first thought was fast, clear, instinctive. Are we being evicted?
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.